This series of Let's Make It Rain is sponsored by PensionBee, a leading online pension provider. They're on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for different savings needs, from a flexible self-employed plan to socially responsible plans like their Impact Plan or Sharia Compliant Plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, you've probably heard me say before that we are our own biggest asset by far, and that includes investing in the next generation. I wrote Cash's Queen exclusively for preteen and teenage girls to equip them with everything they need to take control of their financial futures early. It's been translated into 5 languages and is available worldwide. So grab a copy for you and a friend today. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm excited to be joined by expert commentator and director of public affairs at PensionBee, Becky O'Connor. For longtime rainmakers, you will know that this is the second time that I've had the privilege of getting to interview Becky and have a chat with her on this podcast. So, Becky, thank you so much for lending us your time again. I know that we're going to have so many interesting revelations and discoveries that I hope the rainmakers can start to apply to their circumstances straight away. So why don't you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners, the new listeners, and also just tell us what you've been up to since the last time we spoke.
Oh, sure. Well, firstly, thanks very much for having me back. It's good to be here. So my role is Director of Public Affairs at PensionBee, which means representing the interests of PensionBee's customers and, in fact, all pension savers in the press, but also to policymakers, and just making sure that, you know, our interests are represented, basically. I have a special interest in some of the things that we're going to be talking about today. Mm. I wrote a book called The ESG Investing Handbook, which is all about sustainable investing and, you know, the kind of ins and outs of the different types of investments that you can make, as well as the returns that you could expect and so on. So I'll be drawing on a bit of that knowledge today, I think. And then in terms of what I've been doing since the last time we spoke, I've just been working really hard.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have. So listeners, before we started recording, Becky and I were just having a bit of a catch up. And I said to her, as I always do, I do my due diligence on my guests before they come on. And I went on LinkedIn last night and I saw that Becky had done 18 radio interviews in a day. So that's 18 in a single day.
Crazy.
Not 18. Wild. Becky, what a trooper. Total trooper. And then she's come here this morning, first thing, to come and have a chat with us. So I really, really, truly appreciate her taking the time. So let's get into ESG. And also, Becky, if you wouldn't mind just sharing with us at the end of the conversation how listeners can get access to that handbook, because it sounds amazing.
Oh, thanks.
And I'm sure, you know, with some of the insights that you will share, it will really pique people's interests. So one of the things that I hear quite commonly from the rainmakers is that one of the things that might hold them back from investing, and of course, there are a whole host of things that will come up in our conversations. One of the things that comes up once we get over the initial hurdles is around the relationship in their minds between investing and the environment, and how investing really has got a bit of a bad reputation. You know, it looks very alpha male, very testosterone fueled. When we think about some of the crises from an economic standpoint that lots of us will have lived through, so, you know, the financial crisis of 2008 and all sorts of things happening with interest rates and inflation, etc., it really makes people feel like not just investing is gambling, but also that investing involves putting your money into things that may not necessarily be any good for the environment, for our communities, and for society as a whole. So, first of all, what is ESG investing and why should we care about it? So for the rainmakers that are led towards that because they think, you know, perhaps this is an avenue for me in overcoming some of my misgivings, what would you say?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's another horrible acronym that we've got to get our heads around, isn't it? once you understand it, it's fine. So ESG stands for environmental, social and governance factors. And there are a range of different considerations besides just pure financial return that are layered on top of investment decision making. So, you know, as you said, like investment can seem quite two-dimensional. You know, you invest in stuff that you think is going to make you the highest financial return. Maybe that's the kind of more alpha male version, as you say. But this adds another layer, ESG adds a layer of responsibility to it. And there's different elements of that more responsible, perhaps you could say more holistic way of assessing what you want to invest in. And it doesn't mean that you're going to give up on the financial returns, as we'll come on to, but it does mean that other factors are taken into account when deciding what to invest in. And the ESG factors can sometimes actually confusingly only be applied in the sense that they have an impact on financial returns. But the original intention behind the concept of investing with environmental, social, or governance factors in the mix was to also have hopefully less damaging an impact on the environment and society, and to have good standards of governance for the sake of having good standards of governance, not just because they can also improve financial returns, but because they're good things to think about in and of themselves. We don't need to get into the weeds of ESG, but it has got a bit confused along the way. And there's, you know, various people say it's, you know, not a very good way to invest because it takes you too far away from financial returns. Other people say actually ESG is all about better financial returns in the long term. And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I can sympathize with people about is the fact that, as you rightly say, you know, it's one more acronym. There are so many other terms that are used interchangeably with ESG. So sometimes it's referred to as ethical investing. We might see green investing. Then there's SRI, which is socially responsible investing. So there are lots of different ways of, for all intents and purposes, expressing a similar sentiment, although I imagine there are probably some minor differences between them. Yeah. And so that can be overwhelming. But then you've got this idea that there have been reports that some ESG propositions may not necessarily be what people think they are, and that it requires us to look beneath the bonnet. Can you explain more about that, this idea of what they call greenwashing?
Yeah, so sustainable or ESG investing or green or ethical, they are slightly different, as you say, in terms of definitions. But for the purposes of today, let's lump them all together. Mm-hmm. It has been popular in the last few years. It grew in popularity as a way of investing, especially during the pandemic. I think there was this feeling that if we can make the world a better place and we've got some spare cash because we're not doing anything, that makes sense. So it grew in popularity. Some say that's a trend. I prefer to think of it as more of like a structural kind of thing where people are moving in that direction. But in any case, more money was going into this type of investing. But the problem with it is we don't live in a perfect world. So even some investments or funds that are labelled sustainable may have some companies in them that some people may think are not green enough or are conflicted in some way. So a good example might be lithium mining for electric car batteries. So you would maybe find a company that is mining for lithium, and on the basis that that is going to be used in the manufacture of electric vehicles, could have a positive influence on reducing CO2 emissions globally. But from the point of view of habitat destruction, or, you know, maybe impacting the local community around the mine, may have a negative impact. And for these reasons, if you look under the bonnet of some funds, you may feel disappointed. Now, sometimes that disappointment is something that, you know, we just have to live with, understanding that it's an imperfect world. Sometimes it feels a little bit more like something has been marketed as more than it is. Something has been marketed as green when it isn't really. And the industry has been spending a lot of time, the regulator, the Financial Conduct Authority, has been spending a lot of time looking at what actually counts as green, what actually counts as sustainable, what counts as having a genuine positive impact in the world. And obviously, it's very, very difficult to decide, but they have made a good effort at doing so. And some new labels are coming in this year, actually, that will help people avoid greenwash, because the labels would only be applied to investment funds that can prove they are doing the thing that it says on the label. So that's quite an exciting development, because it helps restore trust, I think, in an area where people, again, feel a little bit like, oh, hang on, you know, this says sustainable, but it's got this in it, so I don't believe it. And actually, I've just lost faith in the whole shebang. Like, I just don't believe any of it anymore. And I'm just going to invest for financial returns again, because that's the one thing I can trust. I don't think we need to be that jaded, but there certainly has been some element of marketing things as, you know, more green than perhaps they really are.
And so, as with all things, it really does require us to use our discernment as to whether one investment really is the best fit for us, or whether there are other options that might work better. So one of the things that's been really interesting to me from a personal perspective is this relationship between our retirement fund and the environment. And I read a brilliant, in fact, I watched a video of someone talking about, he was a former fund manager in the city. I think he'd moved down to the coast, and then he'd started to do some work with a climate change investing fund that was doing some really great work in helping to amplify this message about the impact our money can make from a climate change perspective. And of course, we know that our retirement funds really carry so much weight in the market in terms of where we're invested. And also, I suppose this is a good opportunity for me to remind the Rainmakers that if we are invested in a pension fund, then we're investors, because I think, you know, lots of us can miss the fact that it means that we are investing and that our money is often rooted into things that we have no idea about. So can you just explain a bit more for people that are unfamiliar what the impact is of our money from a pension fund perspective, how, the impact it's making in terms of climate change? What do you think people would be surprised to know?
So pensions are worth trillions globally. We don't tend to think of pensions as, well, we think of them as our money in terms of our retirement funds, but where they're being invested is a bit harder to connect to, because we don't get that information readily from our pension providers. But, you know, we may know a few things sort of dimly about where they're invested, and those things may or may not be correct. I think there's a perception that pension funds are typically invested quite heavily in oil and gas companies, which, you know, are clearly big fossil fuel emitters, contributing to CO2 emissions, which is the biggest challenge really from a climate change perspective that we have as a global society. They do invest in oil and gas companies, but the amount that they invest in oil and gas companies is reducing over time. And it's partly thanks to pressure from climate change groups who have drawn the link between where the money is going from our pensions into the real world out there through the investment funds. Also, companies now have to, well, they don't have to, but are being encouraged to publish net zero targets and CO2 reduction targets and where they intend to be in years to come. So there are oil and gas companies within our pensions, but the amount that is in there is reducing thanks to pressure, basically. Now, pensions are more likely to be more heavily invested in US tech companies. So this is a good thing, that you can have some comfort that your pension is probably less invested anyway in oil and gas now than it used to be. That may change. Pension companies may decide that actually they do need to invest in oil and gas again for those returns, but for the moment they don't need to. There are options now for fossil fuel free pensions and also positive impact pensions. And in fact, we do have those options on PensionBee. You know, so do other providers. There are sustainable pensions now available with a lot of workplace providers. So there is this option to further avoid fossil fuel companies in particular if you want your pension to be more environmentally friendly, which is great news. And, you know, there is, I think, probably more to do and certainly more awareness to build that there is that option, and also more confidence to generate that, you know, choosing that option wouldn't necessarily dent returns. But if you don't want to do that, you can also take comfort from the fact that naturally your pension should be decarbonizing over time. Now, of course, I would say none of that is fast enough. It's not happening fast enough because we have some huge global climate challenges and the rate of warming is now really critical. So if you feel very strongly about that, then one thing to do would be to consider moving to a more sustainable pension than the default one that you're probably already in through your workplace provider.
Brilliant. It's such a fascinating link. And I think it's only when you start to have these sorts of conversations that it really brings it to the surface. It's one of those things that we move through our day-to-day lives, particularly if you're invested in a workplace pension. I think you might have to be a bit more involved when you're setting up your pension yourself. But if you're in a workplace pension, you know, deductions are just taken from your salary and you don't necessarily engage with it.
No, it's a more passive relationship for sure.
Definitely.
And it's moderated by your employer as well. So there's several layers between you and the ultimate pension. I suppose if you're self-employed or you have a personal pension that you have because you've consolidated old workplace pensions, maybe you do feel a bit more like that's yours and you're more responsible for mm-hmm. that. And it, you know, it can be hard. Workplace providers vary considerably, I think, in the amount they enable or connect with the kind of end user, which is us, to give you the option to do things. I remember moving my old workplace pension from the default fund to a sustainable fund. And it was quite stressful because I had tons of risk warnings to get through. You know, are you really sure you want to do this? And I was, but it almost convinced me that I wasn't because they were sort of placing so much kind of heaviness on the decision. It's performed very well since, by the way.
Oh, that's good. So, Becky, let's talk about performance then, because I think one of the concerns that lots of people might have, and you touched on it in the beginning, was about whether or not ethical investing ends up being at the expense of returns. So is it possible for us to really combine our morals and the markets?
Gosh, this is such a live debate. But yes, I believe it is. Certainly from my own experience, I haven't seen any difference. In fact, the funds that are purely sustainable within my pension have performed better than those that aren't. But it doesn't always play out because sometimes, you know, if a fund is kind of very concentrated, very niche, you know, perhaps one area of renewable technology only, then that's very dependent on those few companies doing well. So it depends on lots of other factors, like how diversified that investment is geographically and across different asset classes, what the actual intention of the fund is. So does it intend to generate slow and steady returns, or does it intend to generate high growth? And so with so many different factors at play in determining good investment returns, it's very difficult to say something has done well because it is sustainable. It's also very difficult to say something has done well because it isn't sustainable, because there are so many different interlocking factors. And my personal view on this is you may as well, because there's no proof that it dampens returns. But do be careful of that concentration of too many eggs in one basket, basically. So, and what I mean by that is you can have a sustainable fund which is invested in like 30 companies, or you can have one that's invested in 3,000 companies. And depending on the timing, the one that's invested in 30 companies is likely to be more volatile. So you could see quite a big decline in that fund over a period of time, purely based on, you know, random luck, because it's likely to be more volatile. The one that's better diversified, the returns there are likely to be steadier because it's spread across more companies, and therefore there's more opportunity for some to be doing well while others aren't doing so well. But with the smaller concentration, there is also a chance that you could make much more, but you don't know that. So it comes down to risk tolerance as well. If you had just invested in the positive impact fund with 30 companies, it had done very badly, you may then think, well, I can't invest like this anymore because clearly the positive impact fund hasn't done very well. When in fact, it's not to do with the fact that it's positive impact, it's to do with the fact that it's got 30 companies in it. So these are the things that we kind of need to look for alongside the impact or the sustainability rating of that investment.
I love that because it's a good segue into the fact, a good reminder really for the rainmakers. You know, we talk all the time about risk. We talk all the time about understanding your risk tolerance, but also just appreciating, you know, one of the main principles of investing is thinking about how we can mitigate that risk in recognition of the fact that we take risks all the time. And I know that building a healthier relationship with risk is one of the cornerstones of what we're doing all the time in the Rainmakers Academy, in my conversations with rainmakers, wherever I come across them, wherever they are in the world. And risk always comes up, you know, where people say, you know, it seems too risky or it seems too volatile. And as you have correctly outlined, whether it's for ESG or sustainable investing or anything else, actually, it really is important that we try to mitigate too much concentration in any one area, any one asset class, and any one fund. You know, so where we have an opportunity to spread that risk, and particularly with our pension funds, yes, you know, you've got a longer investment horizon. But if it was for your personal investment decisions and you've got a shorter investment horizon, then perhaps you don't want to have those huge swings potentially, because I suppose equally, Becky, you know, or conversely, I should say, the upside could be, as a result of that concentration, it looks like it's booming because of random luck, because you get in at the right time. And as we know, we are not trying to time the market, are we, as rainmakers?
No, exactly. And one thing that is a bit of an issue, to be completely honest, is that for people looking for income, so people who are approaching retirement, who want to start maybe drawing down, they want lower risk funds, there are fewer purely sustainable options in the investment market there. Because there aren't the range of companies that are sufficiently developed that are truly sustainable companies that they can generate dependable income flows. There are many generating growth. The share prices are rising, albeit, you know, they're a bit up and down, or they have been in the last few years. But in terms of income generation, it's not quite so easy. It's going to grow over time. But at the moment, the options are thinner on the ground there.
Okay, so I want to talk about the number of us that have lost our pensions. So apparently, according to research that Pension B has done in conjunction with CEBR, there's around £50 billion worth of pensions that are potentially at risk of being lost. One in 10 of us could have a pension that's worth more than £10,000 that we've forgotten about. As we move between jobs, we lose track of old providers. How do we get people to crank up the urgency on their pension planning? And I will always return to this message over and over, because I think it's something that people intuitively know. You know, their conscious minds perhaps will say, I really need to sort out my pension, and we'll make it a New Year's resolution, or we'll put it on our to-do list. And then maybe we start the process and it gets too complex, or the admin becomes overwhelming and we abandon. I mean, there are a number of different scenarios, but how do we get people to do something about this?
Maybe we need to stop thinking about it as a pension and start thinking about it as thousands of pounds that we're potentially losing track of.
Right.
That is our hard-earned money. Like, just think about the cold, hard cash, because a pension is sort of like an abstract thing. And also, you know, it's hard. If you've not checked your annual statement lately, you don't know how much is in there. So something that you left behind 10 years ago from a job that you maybe had for a couple of years, and, you know, you moved on very quickly, life moved on, and you're probably thinking in the back of your mind, it's not worth very much. I only paid into it for a couple of years. And maybe you've moved house, so you don't even get the statements anymore. It's very easy to just sort of dismiss that as unimportant, because you just think, oh, it's probably not that much. But of course, if something's worth like £500 when you're 24, by the time you reach 68, with decent investment growth over time, all right, it's not going to pay for your retirement, but it's going to contribute to it, and it's going to be worth thousands, not hundreds. So it's that thing of like, it's thousands of pounds and it's yours.
Yeah.
That I think might help people connect a bit more and, like, you know, want to keep those details handy in a drawer, but also, you know, in your email inbox, in your phone notes, you know, wherever it is you need to keep stuff like policy numbers or the names of pension providers. I mean, I have a little spreadsheet, because I also, you know, my thoughts go a bit morbid sometimes, and I'm like, well, if something happened to me, then my husband would need to know where my pensions are, because I've got four.
Yeah.
I have consolidated some, but I have got four, and, you know, I could tell him that there's no way he'd remember, so I need it all somewhere that, you know, is accessible. And I find it quite useful, because there's one where I'm just like, oh yeah, I've got that one, mustn't forget. because it is worth about £600, but it's there and I will use it.
And it's yours. I'm going to use it. Yeah, and not morbid at all. Thank you so much for raising that point, because again, I mean, we'd had a conversation about some of the different ways we might capture all of our different financial affairs in a single document. And there's something called the death book that one of our rain check favourites, Candice Brathwaite, had first brought to my attention in a post that she had done. But I think pensions, thinking about what happens when we're no longer here and, you know, writing a will, all of these things kind of fall in the same category where we know that they need to be taken seriously, but we just perhaps don't want to confront them. So thank you for raising that, because I think anything that can help to make for an easier transition for the people that we're leaving behind, and also just mean that the money that you worked so hard for can go to your child, can go to your partner, can go to other family members. None of us really want to feel that the money just evaporates or goes to the crown or whatever happens. So,
well, also the thing with what's left in a pension is it's usually free of inheritance tax. So whereas anything else would be part of your estate, if it's in a pension, it's not considered part of your estate, which means it's inheritance tax free, even income tax free if you died before 75. But I mean, nobody wants that to happen. But no. Yeah, it's just good to know that it's taxed differently.
And also, I mean, for anybody that has been following my adventures on the Raincheck Instagram account, you will know that I think it was in January, I talked about discovering an old pension myself. One that, and I'm generally someone that's quite good on my pensions admin, as you might expect. I don't want to be a fraud and be telling people to do something that I'm not doing. But actually still, there was a pension that I didn't even know was there. And I was contacted by Aviva to say, we think we've got a pension that belongs to you. And it was worth 20 grand. So it's really important.
What a nice surprise.
Right? It was such a lovely New Year's surprise. I was, and at first I was like, is this like a scam? The level of due diligence that I went through before I could accept that it was my actual pension. So it really is important, whether it's tens of thousands or hundreds, it's important that we stay on top of it. So thank you for that, Becky. Okay, so at the time of recording, we're still in International Women's Month. It was previously a day, but now it's expanded out into the whole month. And I saw in a recent article that Pension B had talked about a pension gender gap Groundhog Day, which is my sentiments exactly. I say this all the time. Anytime International Women's Day comes around, I'm like, oh my God, am I going to have to talk about the gender pay gap again and the investing gap and the pensions gap? We really ought to have seen far more change at this stage. But we are currently seeing data that shows a difference of 35% in terms of the gender pensions gap. And one of the biggest problems that women confront is childcare costs after maternity, which typically, as a result of us often being the lower paid party due to the gender pay gap, means that it can end up driving us out of the workplace altogether, which then has the knock-on effect on our pensions, as we know. What are some realistic things women can do to, if not accelerate their pension saving and plug some of those gaps, but just perhaps think about how they can take control of it, whatever their start point is?
So the first and obvious thing is to keep contributing. If you can, if you're not working, you can still contribute and get tax relief up to £3,600. So that would be a personal contribution of £2,660 net of tax in a year. Your husband or partner could pay into a pension for you if you're the one taking Brilliant. A hit in the couple and somebody else's career is continuing, which is often the case, then there is that option too. So you both benefit from one person working in terms of pension savings as well. When you do go back to work, if you're on a lower paid basis, you might not be auto-enrolled because the trigger for auto-enrolment is £10,000. So if you're earning under £10,000, or maybe you have a couple of jobs that are paying you less than £10,000, if you're kind of working flexibly and around kids and so on, you can ask to be put into the work pension scheme. It won't happen automatically for you if you're earning under that amount. So that's one thing that you can do. I mean, clearly the big issue is around maternity pay and paternity pay not being equal. So in terms of like large scale solutions, we firmly believe that if we didn't just have shared parental leave, but equal parental pay for both parties, that would help solve the gender pay gap, because there wouldn't be this anticipation that women are going to take more time off than men. Mm. Therefore, it would also help solve the gender pension gap. I mean, there's not much you can do about that as an individual, but I mean, certainly, you know, do look, if you're at the point where you're planning who's going to take time off when your children are very young, do look very closely at whether or not you
can work more than you think as a mother, and the family finances are still relatively balanced. So if your partner or husband is able to take more time off paid than the 2 weeks minimum, which is still unfortunately quite common, then perhaps you want to look at that, and then you're able to get back to work a bit sooner, or you're able to share that leave a bit better. And then that is likely to have less of an impact on your future earnings because you've not taken so much time out. You know, you do need to sit down with a calculator and also all the information about the different leave entitlements between the two of you to try and minimize the individual impact on your own earning potential going forward.
And one additional thing I think for anyone listening is just checking your national insurance record as well. I say just, but it's not just, is it?
Oh,
I
think it's so important. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
The state pension is the bedrock of anybody's retirement income. It's hugely valuable. And you, obviously, if you miss any time of out of work, you're not getting the qualifying years towards your national insurance state pension entitlement. You can get credits if you're caring, and you will need to go through the child benefit system to claim those credits. But you don't need to actually claim the child benefit, but you need to fill out the form to get the credits to make sure you don't miss out on state pension.
Brilliant tip. So one area of potential financial instability that I don't think gets anywhere near the airtime it should, and it was actually brought to my attention by a rainmaker who has this experience, is the impact of providing a caring role for elderly relatives or relatives in general. And PensionB published a report earlier this year that revealed 2 in 3 of us will have to take time out of work to care for loved ones at some point or another in our working lives, which basically suggests that most of us can expect our earnings and therefore our savings to take a hit. One of the things that was most surprising to me, though, is that PensionB's research revealed that men are roughly as likely as women to perform this role. And I think, you know, lots of us, I bet if I were to do just a random, you know, straw poll, I think most people would assume, particularly after the events that unfolded during the pandemic, I think most people would assume that women shoulder disproportionate responsibility for some of these roles from a caring perspective. But how can each of us as individuals prepare for this possibility financially, whether we are men or women? And how can policy be developed to support it, do you think?
So that is what the report found. I think with childcare, women still shoulder the burden of responsibility during those years, the early years and the caring for children. And that is, you know, generally speaking, affects somebody for a longer period of time. But we found that later in life, kind of 60 plus, the gender split in terms of caring responsibilities or the need to take time out of work to care is roughly even between men and women. And it's usually, you know, at 2 or 3 years out of work, and it can be caring for a partner or it can be caring for elderly relatives. It's more likely to be elderly relatives at that particular point in time. So what can you do? At this point, usually people are actually often able to access their pension savings. And whilst you need those pension savings to fund your own retirement and to last the distance, so you don't want to overuse them, if you need to take time out of work to care for somebody, you need some sort of replacement income. So it could be that that's the time to tap into your 25% tax-free lump sum. Again, you don't have to take the full 25%, just whatever you need to tide you over during that period where your earnings are reduced, either because you're not working at all, because you're caring, or because you've gone part-time. Now, the research did show that usually the need to care for somebody is not permanent, can last many years, but generally it's a few years. So that then suggests that there's a possibility of returning to work or increasing your hours again at some point, provided you yourself are still in good health. So then you can increase your earnings. And even if you've started to tap into your pension, you can still pay into your pension again, even once you've started to access it, if you return to work. But just bear in mind that if you have started to take an income from your pension, a taxable income, when you go back to work and you start paying into your pension, a new limit applies on the contributions that you can make, which is £10,000 a year, which should, you know, that's a reasonable amount to still, you know, be able to keep boosting your pension. But I think, you know, we just need to bear in mind that these moments happen in life, and the older we get, the more likely it is that we need to take a bit of time out to care for people. Even after the childcare years are done, there are still people who might depend on us. Yeah. And to just allow for that possibility while you're building up your pension savings and to just be thinking about, okay, well, I might not want to retire fully until I'm 68, but I also recognize that there's likely to be a time, maybe in my 50s, maybe in my early 60s, where I might have to sort of do a sort of like mini early retirement. And it's not retirement because you're caring for somebody, but a time when I might need my pension that's before I've retired. And just keep that in mind.
Really useful insights. And I think for anybody that finds themselves in that role, I think it's also useful to know that whilst it's a challenging situation, that there are still, you know, and in contrast to the lengthier period at the start of, if you might be caring for children, for example, that, you know, later life caring, different set of circumstances, different challenges, of course, but that there are still opportunities for us to identify ways to invest into our pension still. So that's encouraging. So let's talk numbers then. And this is quite a frightening question, but I know that it's top of most people's minds. And one of the things that can really terrify us about when we look at our pension pots and go, oh my God, well, I'm going to be working, you know, people will say really flippantly, well, I'm just going to have to work until I die then. How much should we be saving? And, you know, I don't want to force you, I don't want to pin you against a wall and say, are there any benchmarks or targets, Becky, you know, by age? Or, you know, sometimes you'll see by 30, you should have this amount, by 40, you should have this amount, which I, in one respect, I can see it's quite terrifying. But then in another, I wonder whether it gives people a useful guide to work towards. Is there any kind of, you know, more concrete guidance that you can give people around how much we should be saving, more than just however much you can afford?
I wish there was a magic formula. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, you know, one of the big constraints is how much you earn and what your other living costs are. So the first answer is really as much as you can possibly afford, mm-hmm. That you don't need for your income needs and also like a little bit of fun in life. So there is that. Now, the averages to think about, I suppose, are by the time people get to their mid-60s, on average, people have about just over £100,000 in their private pension savings that they've built up through work. Now, that plus a full state pension would be likely to give you a living standard in retirement of between basic and moderate, but probably still a bit more towards the basic end. So it would be kind of, I don't know, maybe £17,000 or £18,000 a year. Now, depending on your circumstances, that may or may not sound like enough for you to live on. And of course, you may have a partner who maybe have the same sort of level. And when you retire and there's two of you, there's some economies of scale. So you need slightly less each in your pension pots, if you see what I mean, to fund the same lifestyle. But if you're on your own, you need slightly more to fund that lifestyle. But that would give you somewhere between a basic and moderate. So extrapolating then to get above a moderate living standard in retirement, which is where you maybe take a week's holiday, have a few more luxuries, maybe eat out a little bit more. You would need to increase that average pot size, which is £100,000, to probably something more like approaching £200,000. And I'm keeping it vague because the living standards change as well and they're quite mm-hmm. subjective. So the risk is I could say £200,000, fine for a moderate living standard. And then somebody goes, well, £200,000. I heard that was going to be enough and it doesn't feel like enough now. It is still quite subjective. And then for a comfortable, now a single person, according to the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association, would be looking at a pot size, a range of between like 500,000 and 750,000, which may sound like a lot to achieve, particularly if you're, you know, 50 and, you know, you've got nothing like that yet. If you're in a couple, that does come down to something more like 300,000 each.
Wow.
It's still pretty punchy. So depending on the pension scheme that you're in through work, you may have very generous employer matching available to you. I would say if that's available and you're not taking advantage of that fully, then consider doing so, because for a small increase in what you're putting in yourself, you may get a big increase from what your employer can put in, which may help you reach that target more quickly. If you're several years away from retirement, then make sure you're not invested too cautiously, because those investment returns, the growth, year on year growth, if it's 5%, you're going to end up with a much bigger pot than if you're averaging 3% a year, even though it doesn't sound like a huge difference. Keep an eye on the fees that you're paying on your pension, because that can eat into returns. And all of these things, you know, ultimately can mean the difference between having a comfortable lifestyle or a more moderate one, whatever that means to you.
So when we think about, we come to the end of our working lives and we want to live our best lives and we've got these pensions that we've accrued and everyone has listened to your brilliant advice and, you know, applied everything. We've got a full national insurance record and we've got a fully funded pension. How do we get access to it? So can we withdraw it all in one go? Do we pay ourselves a monthly amount? Who decides and how is it taxed?
Oh, this is where it gets really interesting and it's slightly stressful because there are several ways you can access it and it can be quite complicated, particularly if you've got different pensions that have different benefits. So if you've got like an old defined benefit scheme, that will be completely different the way you access it to a defined contribution scheme, because usually that will give you guaranteed income. The tax-free lump sum stuff works slightly differently there as well. So I'm going to focus on the defined contribution ones because they're the ones that most people have now. So usually the way it goes is people reach a certain age, they access some of their tax-free lump sum first because they usually, you know, 55, most people are still working. So they don't actually need the whole pension. They don't even need to take a proper income from the pension because they're still working. If you're working part-time and, you know, that might be slightly different, you might want to start taking more of an income from your pension, particularly if you've managed to build up a hefty amount. So the 25% tax-free lump sum, it makes sense to take that first, often, not always. You then would go into either drawdown, where it's usually called flexi access drawdown, where once you've taken your tax-free amount, you then start to take smaller amounts as income and they are taxable at your normal rate. So if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you pay 20% tax on those withdrawals as you would if you were earning. You can instead do something called, this is like the worst acronym ever, but it's uncrystallized fund pension lump sums. Off plus. Forget it. Just forget it. I've already said it and I just regret saying it. But it's where you take smaller lump sums and 25% of each of those is tax-free and the rest is taxable. Now, that's less common and less popular and also slightly more confusing from a tax point of view than taking the tax-free amount first and then starting to take the taxable income. The other alternative is that you take your tax-free lump sum and instead of doing flexi access drawdown, where your pot remains invested, but you're taking an income as and when you need it, you can buy an annuity with the rest of your pot. An annuity is a guaranteed income either for a set period or for the rest of your life. And you may get some annuity quotes and think, well, that sounds like a really good deal. I've got £100,000. If I give it all to the insurance company, they're going to pay me £7,000 a year for the rest of my life. Or you might hear that and you might think, "Ma, that doesn't sound like a good deal. Actually, if I keep my money invested and I just withdraw bits as and when I need them, I reckon I'll end up with a higher return and be able to withdraw more annually than the amount they're quoting me." Now, that's partly personal choice. It's partly like a little bit of educated guessing. People make different decisions. Annuities have become more popular lately because as interest rates have risen, the returns you get from annuities have also risen. So whereas 5 years ago, basically hardly anyone was buying annuities because they were such poor value, now they're more popular again because for £100,000, you may get £7,000 a year. 5 years ago, you would have been looking at maybe £4,000 a year. Not many people were choosing it. So it does depend on market conditions as well as your own personal financial plans for retirement and what you think you will need and when. And whether you're still working. Lots of things to think about.
So it really is, I mean, for people that say, "Dav, what would be a reason for me to see a financial advisor? What might be some of the triggers?" I certainly think that when it comes to your retirement planning and thinking about this conundrum, it really could pay to get some professional financial advice.
It really could. Although today the Financial Conduct Authority put out a review around retirement advice and found that some advisors were not actually doing the work to create good outcomes for people. So I think your choice of advisor is quite important. And there are some good websites where you can look and find specialists in exactly what you need, like unbiased.co.uk.
Brilliant. Yes. There is another one, Vouched For, but yeah, Unbiased. Yes. Yeah. So those two, Rainmakers, and I'll put it in the show notes as well. So Becky, just coming to the end then of our conversation, I always feel like the time really flies, but this has been something that's been, I've been reading so much about. It's been, you know, certainly front of my mind when it comes to this area. And it's the great wealth transfer. And I've read a number of articles about, you know, this huge amount of money that's set to be falling into our laps imminently. I mean, I've been waiting for someone to drop mine off.
I think it's just going to pass over my lap, to be honest.
Right? And so we've got that. We've got, you know, the amount of wealth that UK women will be controlling by 2025. And when I was talking about that a few years ago, 2025 felt like 1,000 years away. And now I'm like, wow, isn't 2025 next year? So apparently 60% of UK wealth will be controlled by women by 2025. Now, of course, you have to read a bit more deeply into that and look where that's come from. But let's focus on the great wealth transfer for now, which basically reveals, apparently, that millennials and our successors, so I'm at the top end of millennial, we are due to be on the receiving end of the most significant transfer of wealth in modern history, to the tune of trillions of dollars. It sounds so dramatic and exciting. So in the US, apparently it's $84 trillion. And in the UK, £5.5 trillion will be passed down by our baby boomer parents and grandparents. So my question, I've got many questions about this, not least how I'm going to get mine. But is waiting for an inheritance a reasonable retirement planning strategy?
Oh my gosh, no, it really isn't. I mean,
I know people think it, they'll laugh and they'll be like, but deep down they're thinking, could I just do that? No, right,
don't,
Becky?
Don't. It's not your money until it's your money. It's really not. And there's so many things that get in the way with the best will in the world, even if, you know, your parents or other older relatives really want to do right and, you know, leave you a decent amount of money. There's so many things that could get in the way of that. Like, what if they need to pay for care? What if they have actually miscalculated how much they need in retirement and they need to take more income for themselves? Or they might need to sell the house to release some equity for their own retirement, not to give to you so that you can buy a house or for your own plans. I mean, you know, you might think there's hundreds of thousands of pounds coming your way, but what if they just haven't even thought about offering a living inheritance and you're too polite to ask? Certainly that describes a lot of us. And then they're 95 when they die and you're 70 and past caring, and you know, even your kids are kind of like, gosh, we've, you know, given up on buying a house now. So yeah, it's just, there's too many variables. It might happen. How nice if it does. If it doesn't, then, you know, don't feel too disappointed or resentful or anything like that, because life happens even when you're older, and what you think you've got, you don't necessarily have. So
it's a no.
Tread carefully with that one.
Tread carefully. Yeah. We should treat it as a lovely surprise if it happens, but certainly not a cornerstone of our retirement or financial planning strategy, and certainly not our home ownership strategy.
No, listen, I mean, the exception would be, I suppose, if you know you've got some money in trust.
Which is different.
That doesn't apply to many people. But if you know that's different, maybe you can then proceed. But,
but for everybody else, no. Becky, thank you so, so much for your time today. As usual, I feel we could have gone on for another few hours, but I'm sure you probably want a bit of downtime after those 18 interviews yesterday.
I can hear my voice going. I can hear it. I need a Strepsil.
So first of all, where can people get their hands on a copy of your book, and where can people find you in general?
Oh, thanks. So the ESG Investing Handbook is available on Amazon or via the Harriman House website, which is the publisher's website. And for more on pensions, pensionbee.com is very great. We've got lots of calculators to help you work out if you're on track and what you need to do to increase your contributions to be on track, plus a lot of other information.
And if you're listening in from the US, you may have missed the news that PensionBee is expanding into the US, which is brilliant news for UK fintech, brilliant news for pension savers everywhere in the world. We love PensionBee, obviously. So yeah, do look out for that if you're on that side of the world too. Becky, thank you so much and enjoy the rest of your day.
Loved it. Thanks.
Hi. Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.